Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Egypt to talk with a young 17-year-old reporter, Jessica El-Sayed, with Youth Journalism International. Since her generation is driving the revolution, we'll get her reaction to Mubarak's bizarre non-resignation speech that has enraged Egyptians. Then we'll get an analysis of this moment of delusion and confusion as the Egyptian dictator defiantly holds on to power against the wishes of the increasingly angry Egyptian people demanding his exit. Elliot Kohler, the chair of the Department of Arabic and Islamic Studies at Georgetown University, who testified this week to the Congress, joins us. Then finally, we will talk with Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, about the budget cuts the divided Republican Congress are proposing. Let's now go to Alexandria, Egypt. I'm speaking with Jessica El-Sayed, who is a senior reporter with Youth Journalism International. She is in Alexandria, Egypt, a 17-year-old student, and you have just watched, as all of your countrymen and women have, Jessica, President Mubarak, make what was expected to be a farewell address, if you will, and instead he made this peculiar, defiant, recalcitrant, confusing talk. To just tell me, what's your reaction, and what did you take away from that?
Well, he pretty much left me and my family in complete shock and anger. It was completely unexpected that he would come out and say this, because few minutes and even hours before the speech was aired, there was a lot of speculation on whether or not he would come out and finally step down. So at this moment, Tahrir Square is pretty much on fire. We've even seen reports about people fainting, people getting heart attacks. This speech was the worst of. I mean, this is his third, and even the two that he's done before weren't as provocative, I guess, to the people. He pretty much just came out and said, you know, I'm here, I'm not leaving, no matter what you ask. It's very difficult to take in, especially for people who are in the streets at the moment, families that, you know, finally felt that they would have justice, who their sons or brothers or wives or daughters have been killed during this protest. It wasn't an easy ride. I mean, a lot was sacrificed, a lot was done. Today is the 17th, I think 18th day since the 25th of January. And it seems that he just won't budge.
And Jessica El-Sayed, do you think that somehow there was some kind of an agreement behind the scenes? Why would everybody have expected him to resign, and including the President of the United States? And he's supposed to have pretty good information. Is it possible that he sort of half-heartedly agreed to something and then simply at the last minute couldn't bring himself to make the concession to leave?
Yeah, you're perfectly right. I mean, what happened was, a few hours before his speech, we've gotten reports from CNN, NBC saying that Mubarak will resign tonight. And these kind of reports just weren't available in our media. Jazeera didn't have this. Another channel called Al Arabiya didn't have this. And this is where we follow the demonstrations. So the fact that these kind of news channels were seeing this, in the Middle East, we trust those sources because we know that they wouldn't ever run this kind of important news unless it was true. So we heard that the CIA was saying that there are reports about him leaving. Just these kind of reports that, you know, put these ideas, I guess, in our heads. A few minutes before the speech, there was a lot of celebration in Tahrir Square. In my house, music was playing. We started hearing, people cheering in the streets, cars honking, because we felt, you know, victory is near. And that's why it was extremely emotional, because, you know, just psychologically, it was a lot to take in. I personally think that Mubarak needs some kind of, I mean, his speech doesn't need political analysis. He needs, like, psychological analysis, because it seems that he just cannot back down from power. We still don't understand why it was said that he would resign if he didn't. Also, before his speech, there was a word by the general from the military, and he made a statement saying that the military and the army would stay with the people, would ensure that the people get their demands. So that gave us hope too, because we felt that maybe the military finally decided to take a definitive position, saying that we oppose this, that we oppose the dictator, we oppose the regime, and stand 100% with the people.
Again, I'm speaking with Jessica El Sayed, who's a 17-year-old reporter in Alexandria, Egypt. She's a senior reporter with Youth Journalism International, and she, like all Egyptians, were glued to state television with the expectation that Hosni Mubarak would make a resignation speech. Instead, he made a very defiant and rather confusing speech. He mentioned, Jessica, foreign intervention, foreign plots, foreign forces that he won't bow down to. What is he talking about?
Well, I'm sure that he's talking about Obama's several statements saying that democracy needs to come to Egypt now. You know, I mean, the thing is that, and the way we see it from this point is that today there was a report that Obama has spoken to the King of Saudi Arabia, and that Saudi Arabia, you know, being the regime that it is, wants Mubarak to stay. It even offered Mubarak to pay. They offered to pay Mubarak the amount of money of U.S. aid that America used to give if the U.S. fails to give it. So I feel at this point, you know, Mubarak is finally showing his true colors to the West. This is the image that, you know, we've been seeing for a while, but this is what, you know, me and everyone else in Egypt has always wanted the rest of the world to see, especially the U.S. government, to understand that this man is just not right in the head. These statements aren't necessarily, I feel, you know, and this is just my viewpoint, but they're not just a political statement where they're saying, you know, I refuse, you know, foreign intervention. I think it's just him and his pride thinking that, you know, who are you to tell me to leave? His own people are telling him to leave. You know, if he turned on TV while he was speaking, he would have seen the millions of people with their shoes raised in the air saying, leave, leave, leave. So we're just as puzzled as you guys back in the U.S. because, you know, we feel that our message is very clear. Everyone has heard it. Why can't he understand it?
So, Jessica, what do you think is going to happen tomorrow? There was an expectation before the announcement of Mubarak's address tonight that tomorrow there would be substantial demonstrations, and perhaps the people in Tahrir Square would march on the palace, on Mubarak's home, his palace. And presumably that would lead to a showdown where I imagine the military or the police or both would protect the Mubarak's palace, would they not? So do you I thought this speech tonight was going to avoid what seemed like, when I talked to people yesterday in Egypt, it seemed like Friday would be a bloody showdown. So what's your expectation, what will happen tomorrow?
Yeah, well, before the speech, we were all, you know, pretty sure that this speech would cancel tomorrow's, not cancel, but at least, you know, calm people down a little bit so you wouldn't have millions of people in the streets. But, you know, it was a complete opposite reaction. I mean, this is, his speech today is going to backfire completely. I think that now tomorrow is going to turn into just, you know, millions of people enraged by this. You know, if he wanted good for himself and, you know, for his own safety and for his own country, if he did love his country for real, he wouldn't have came out to do this kind of speech at this time, especially since he knows that tomorrow there'd be demonstrations. I think tomorrow is going to be the biggest, I can say, human gathering in modern history. Because even before the speech, it was said that 15 million people were going to be, were going to gather tomorrow. So this will make it worse. As for the presidential palace, yeah, these rumors, and not necessarily rumors, these plans were said to be done today, tomorrow. I'm not sure about them, not because they won't happen, but because I do have a feeling they might happen tonight. You know, just at a moment of anger, they might decide to march now, in a few minutes, tomorrow in the morning. You know, at this point, it's very hard to predict things because, you know, there's a new event every couple of hours. As for the military protecting the presidential palace, this is the kind of thing that we hope for and hope not to get disappointed. So we're hoping, and we know, because we know for sure from the army, that they will never hurt us. You know, they said it before, we will never point our guns at you. You know, the military have a feel of human, just human existence. You know, the police were just brutal. They don't care. You know, they treated people like sheep. The military aren't like that. You know, they respect human beings. They won't hurt, you know, his fellow brother, his sister, all the people in the streets. You know, the people in the military in Tahrir Square have lived with these people over the past, you know, 3 weeks. They've eaten with them, drank with them. You know, it's hard. So, you know, they're one family at this point. So we're hoping that this bond would prevent the military from stopping the protesters to go to the presidential palace.
But again, I'm speaking with Jessica El-Sayed, who's a 17-year-old reporter in Alexandria, Egypt. She's a senior reporter with Youth Journalism International. And we're talking about Mubarak's speech to the Egyptian nation that did not meet any expectations and left both observers over here and Egyptians, citizens, completely confused. He did at one point say that he delegated some of presidential authority and constitutional authority to his vice president. But I think we should all remind ourselves, when you speak about the military, Jessica, that Mubarak, Suleiman, and Sadat before him, they all came from the military. The people in Tahrir Square represent, for the first time, the possibility of Egyptian democracy that comes from the people, not from the military. Rule from the people, not from the military. I mean, aren't these facts?
Yes, that is true. At some point when we were sure that he was going to resign and that the military would take control, even in the statement that the military had made before the speech, if they were to take power, they wouldn't take it forever, or, you know, it wouldn't turn into a military state. It would be like that for a transitional phase until a civilian would take over and things would go, you know, back to normal. So Suleiman is just as bad as Mubarak. This is the thing that, you know, even some people here sometimes fail to understand, is that a corrupt regime, you know, someone who's corrupt will only hire someone who's corrupt. It makes no sense to say that the people under Mubarak's rule are any better. So, Suleiman being in power, nothing has happened. He still doesn't want to understand that. People demand removal of the regime. It's been the chant that I've been chanting for the past week, that people in Tahrir have been chanting for the past week, and all the Egyptian governance. he fails to understand that point. Egypt does not have a democracy, you know, and now it's clear to the world, but this is something that people here live every day, and they're tired, and, you know, if the time is now to take back their rights, they're not going to stop. We all fail to comprehend why he, you know, chose to fuel the revolution even more, but clearly, you know, it is what it is, and the revolution, I believe, will succeed. You know, when will victory come? No one knows, but we're not giving up for sure.
And Jessica, if your prediction is right, that people in the square that are so angry at this bizarre turn of events, that they may start marching on the presidential palace as we speak. Even if, I mean, the intention is to do it tomorrow, but it may happen spontaneously. That's what you just mentioned. I mean, I guess we're going to have to watch the television, but it could get bloody. I mean, even though, as you say, the military have, before the speech, said that they would only be in a transitional period. When it comes down to a mob attacking the presidential palace, I can't imagine that won't get bloody.
Yeah, I agree, sadly, but a certain mentality that we need to understand about the people in Tahrir and anyone who goes down to the demonstrations, really, is that before they leave their houses and before they go down, they put in their head that this could be, you know, the last time they're home, because the people in Tahrir Square are ready to die for this, for democracy, for freedom, for liberty, for justice, for so much that this country has been lacking for so long. There's so, like before, there's so much here that isn't exposed because of the regime, and you know, they can't brainwash a nation any longer, because, you know, there's the internet, there's TV, there's too much media and too much technology to have people blindfolded from the rights that they should have, you know, for all this time. So the people in Tahrir Square, you know, I'm not saying, you know, they want blood or they're ready for blood, but yes, they don't want blood, but they're ready for it. If it means to them that if they were to get hurt or killed for the revolution, for the sake of Egypt's freedom, then so be it. In Tahrir Square, the pictures of the 300 that died, you know, are hung. They have their shirts up, their bloody shirts up, and, you know, not to scare the people, just to say that these people were just like you, and you know, now they're our heroes. So you know, even in my personal experience, before I went to the protests here in Alexandria, and those weren't as, you know, as violent as the ones there, I said bye to my whole family, because I understand the risks, and they all do, but they're ready to take them.
Well, Jessica, I know it's very late for you, and just one last comment, if I can get from you.
You
mentioned the shirts, the bloody shirts of all of the martyrs, the 300 that have been killed so far. Mm-hmm. I take it that when the executive from Google was on television with the very popular television anchor, which apparently had a profound effect. I don't know whether you watched that, but he talked about the real heroes being the people who died. So just describe that moment to you, because we're told that really brought the crowds out into Tahrir Square the next day.
Yeah, that's completely true. You know, even I went to the protest after that day. My mom did. Lots of people I know did. Name is significant because he just represents, you know, he's one of the good, you know, like I said before, the good of the Egyptian people. He's one of those people, You know, he works for Google. You know, he has a great job, has a great home in Dubai. He has, you know, he just represents, you know, the dreams that all the youth of Egypt have. And here he is leading a somewhat, you know, luxurious life, even outside of Egypt, but still has enough patriotism and enough love for his country to put up the group We Are All Khaled Said, who's a man, a young man in his 20s, who was dragged out of a cafe and beaten by police in June, here in my city of Alexandria. He didn't do anything at all, but, you know, this is the martial state that we live in. Police can come in anytime, beat you, kill you, do whatever they want, and get away with it. So, and that's what happened. They got away with it. So what Wael Ghanim did was he made a page on Facebook, called it We Are All Khaled Said in Arabic, and, you know, just kept track of the situation, made posts, and it got a lot of attention. Later, after the Tunisian revolution, he's the one who made the first event called Day of Revolution for Egypt on the 25th of January. So I think, of course, you know, that's why the Egyptian government found him and took him into questioning. He was in their custody for 10 days. So he came down to join the people in Tahrir on the second day of protests. And since then, you know, his parents haven't heard from him, his wife hasn't heard from him, and it was a big deal. You know, how could a man just go missing? You know, and not how could a man. Well, this isn't rare. There are still lists of people that are missing now, but you know, being the person that he is, Wael Ghanim went missing. People were looking for him, and then turns out that he was with the government. He went on that show a few hours after he came out, so he is very much still emotional and still shaken by the, you know, by the whole process, because he was blindfolded for 10 days. He even refused, you know, to insult any of the people that took him in, and he just showed so much nobility and respect, even though these people, you know, tortured him. So it was really just great to see him back, and the fact that he came on the show in tears, you know, in love for his country. And what happened was the presenter, the woman that interviewed him, showed him pictures of the people who died, and that's when he hadn't seen them before, and that's when he really started crying, and that's what moved, you know, just the whole country was crying with him. You know, we were crying here, everywhere. I've just heard about, you know, old men and men crying at the TV because of Wael Ghanim. So, yeah, definitely next day, even people who weren't completely convinced with the revolution before were just like, no, you know, this can't happen to Wael Ghanim, and they were there.
Well, Jessica El-Sayed, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you.
From Alexandria. Again, she's a 17-year-old reporter in Alexandria, Egypt, who's a senior reporter with Youth Journalism International. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with an American specialist on Egypt who testified to the United States Congress this week. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Elliot Kohler, who's chair of the Department of Arabic and Islamic Studies at Georgetown University. He's the author of Conflicted Antiquities, Egyptology, Egyptomania, and Egypt Modernity. He also translates work of contemporary Arabic literature, including Ibrahim Aslan's novel The Heron, Idris Ali's Poor, and Ibrahim Al-Honi's Gold Dust, as well as works by others. He is currently working on a study entitled 9/1001, Readings in the Arabian Nights. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you.
And you testified this week to the United States Congress about events unfolding in Egypt. But I imagine, being a specialist on Egypt, you were still nevertheless caught by surprise by Mubarak's non-concession.
That's right. The story that we're watching unfold is simple and complicated. And there's certain parts that remain constant and almost predictable. And there's other parts that continue to astound us, like today's non-departure of Mubarak.
And what do you think happened there? Do you think there was something going on prior to this? Otherwise, we have to conclude that American intelligence is not particularly good, because the president almost indicated he was about to depart. The CIA director suggested in testimony today that he thought he was going to depart, and he didn't. So would it be possible that he'd agreed and then at the last minute he simply couldn't do it because he's obviously has a massive paternalistic ego?
Well, we won't know for a while, and I won't claim to know, but what I would say is this, that on the one hand, we have a fairly complicated array of pro-democracy allies. And on the other, it's beginning to look like the opponents of the pro-democracy movement in Cairo and Alexandria and throughout the country is similarly complicated. And what I mean by that is within Egypt, we have what appears to be a set of splits opening up. And this, I think, was always part of the hopes, if not strategies, of the pro-democracy movement. The splits that are opening up are around, on the one hand, Hosni Mubarak and his immediate family and his close confidants. And on the other hand, members of the ruling party who have been peeling off for days now. These are top members within the ruling party, and including at this point virtually everybody in his cabinet, including an old professor of mine who was quickly made minister of culture, and he resigned. Everyone is resigning. So that's one split that's happening up between Hosni Mubarak, the person, his family, and the party. Now, on the other hand, there's another split that appears to be taking place. It's going to take either a few hours or a few days to figure out what the split is. But it's part of it is a split between the army and the police, or state security forces within Egypt. And those are traditionally separate. And then within the army, and I think this is the part we don't understand yet, there's clearly splits within the army that are nominally under Mubarak's rule, right? He is also commander-in-chief. And members of the army came out today, in fact, the official body of the army, the Council of Armed Forces, came out with a very interesting pronouncement on the showing their distance from him and from Suleiman, who is second in command. Now, the part we haven't heard from yet are the two sections of the armed forces that are not under the command of the other generals, and those are the Republican Guard and the Presidential Guards. These are the people who report directly to Hosni Mubarak. The thing is, these guys are better trained and they're better armed than the others. And the army, probably throughout the last 2.5 weeks, has been very wary about going up against these guys, because in a fair fight, these guys would probably win. And so I think what we're seeing right now is members within the army asserting their own independence, both Mubarak and Omar Suleiman, and perhaps taking a position that may lead to a confrontation with these other forces, the Republican and Presidential Guards, that are going to be loyal to Hosni Mubarak.
Now Elliot Kohler, though, yeah. as we've experienced in these last few weeks, events catch us by surprise, and it's almost an organism of its own, this vast crowd in Tahrir Square. And there is rage and disappointment at Mubarak's defiance. And there was an expectation that tomorrow there would be a march from Tahrir Square to the presidential palace. It may actually happen as we speak. One doesn't know. So if that were to happen, the mob just turned on Mubarak's residence, would the presidential guard then fire on the people?
Well, that's to be seen, and it has happened sometimes in revolutions. And that is a turning point when revolutions happen. It's always a turning point if and when the army decides to shoot on the civilians. It hasn't happened in Egypt. Remember, that was the turning point in Tunisia when Ben Ali ordered his troops ordered the troops to fire on civilians. His general said no, and that was the moment that he had to leave. And that's that hasn't happened yet in Egypt. The one thing I would say is this is a disappointed crowd. They are angry. I do not believe I wouldn't describe them as a mob or being angry in the sense that for 2.5 weeks these are people who have been meeting with no leadership and a really simple and very clear set of demands, and they haven't budged from that message in 2.5 weeks. What are the demands? An end of one-party rule, an end of official corruption, an end of to police brutality, free and fair elections, human rights, civil rights, and so on. So far, this is a mass of people. They are incredibly well organized, given that there is no central command, and they are on message. They've remained on message. And part of the reason is that this is coming really from the people. The bulk of these people are not necessarily political actors or activists. At this point, the bulk of the people in Tahrir Square and on the Corniche in Alexandria are normal people who have wondered, who have wished for Hosni Mubarak to leave now for 30 years and have been waiting for an Egyptian state to do anything in their lives other than maybe arrest their sons and daughters. So, I mean, what's going to happen tomorrow, I don't know. And I do believe that there will be elements who would like it to descend into violence. Now, but I just want to stress that until this moment, the protests have been peaceful and focused, and their demands are clear and almost universal, right? These are things that most people want: civil rights, human rights, and civilian government. They've had 30 years of military rule, and they don't want any more of it. 60 years, I should say, 30 under Mubarak, but 30 before him. And so if there's violence tomorrow, I would predict it's not going to be coming from the pro-democracy movement, but it may well be instigated, and I fear what might happen. But as we saw 2 weeks ago, when violence erupted, it wasn't from the demonstrators. It was really instigated by Mubarak's thugs. So that may, I suspect at this point, this is a regime that's lost all its friends. There's nobody left in the party who openly supports Hosni Mubarak. I mean, there may be some, but everyone is coming out asking him to come down. The state newspaper came out, and everyone is just and the party, his own party, asked him to step down. So this is a man now with no friends. What we saw today on television was the last of the last, I think, speeches of the dictator. I don't know where he could go, and the fact that he wants to stay is worrisome. And yes, to answer your question, finally, things may happen tomorrow and it may be violent, but I don't believe it's going to. The catalyst is not the disappointment of the crowd right now. The catalyst is all those dead enders in the Mubarak regime who will not budge.
Again, I'm speaking with Elliot Cole, who's chair of the Department of Arabic and Islamic Studies at Georgetown University. He testified to the U.S. Congress earlier this week. And what sort of made me think in these terms, though, Elliot Cole, was that this big demonstration has been planned, and it's also been said that there was an intention for the crowd to march on the palace, not to sack the palace, but to march on the palace. If, as you've pointed out, there is a cleavage here within the military between the regular army and the presidential guards, then that does open the possibility of dead enders defending the dictator till the last. So that's why I brought up the question of the possibility of violence.
No, and remember, between Tahrir Square, and they're marching to an old presidential palace called Qasr al-Din. It is not the main presidential palace now that Mubarak uses. As far as I understand, tomorrow the march is on Qasr al-Din. What lies right between Tahrir Square and Qasr al-Din is the Ministry of the Interior. Now on floors 4 and 5 of the Ministry of the Interior are the torture floors. These are the floors that people like Omar Suleiman used and his captains used to torture ordinary Egyptian civilians. So I suspect if on the way to Qasr al-Din, a large crowd happens to stop at the Ministry of the Interior, I suspect there'll be something happening there tomorrow, because that in popular consciousness, that the Ministry of the Interior is a place to, it's the Bastille. If we're looking for that, it would be there. And that's also going to be a place where some people probably within the regime would put up a fight. It won't be, but again, I shouldn't go further than that, but that's where my imagination goes right now when I'm thinking about tomorrow.
Well, I just looked at a Twitter from, or a tweet, or whatever they call them, from Mohammed El Baradei, which was a few minutes ago. He said Egypt is about to explode. The Egyptian ambassador in Washington has said that Omar Suleiman is assuming presidential duties. Obviously, that is confusion, shall we say. But I read a piece, and I interviewed co-editor Jadalia. You've posted stuff on there as well, Elliot Kohler. She was telling me, Hajar?
Yeah.
Yes, Lisa Hajar. And she was talking about Suleiman in terms of not just that he has an association with torture, that he's actually hands-on torturer. I mean, I find it extraordinary to think that we are looking for stability from a man like that.
Right. Look, what is difficult to listen to coming from the city I live in Washington, D.C., is all this talk about order, and needing to restore order. Now, and this, because this has precisely been Hosni Mubarak's line for 30 years, we may not give you rights, we may not give you hope for the future, we may not give you economic opportunities, but we give you stability. The fact is that since 1992, the Egyptian state has been absent in terms of providing any meaningful help to Egyptians in terms of health, in terms of education, in terms of basic things like enforcing building codes and so on, right? And to claim that this is a state that has ever been able to provide order to the people is remarkable. I mean, when the state, when the police disappeared a couple weeks ago from the street, what did the Egyptian people do? They set up their own police policing groups in their neighborhoods. They picked up trash. They relied on themselves. This is because they've been relying on themselves at least since 1992. These things don't get done. The Egyptian state provides nearly no social services for Egyptians, and the police don't solve crimes or prevent crimes so much as arrest boys and girls who look at them funny. I mean, so yes, order is not. This is not a regime that can provide order or any kind of benefits in that regard to the Egyptian people. Now, I mentioned how complicated the array of opposition is to the pro-democracy movement inside Egypt. We need to remember that there's an array of or opponents to a popular revolution in Egypt outside of Egypt too. For instance, Saudi Arabia and the other authoritarian regimes in the Arab world, they have no interest in letting Egypt set an example for their own people. The Obama administration, like other administrations in the U.S. before him, has always preferred not to think about Egypt or just to think of it as a status quo, a black box. As long as Egypt provides intelligence on the war on terror, as long as it enforces the Camp David Treaty with Israel, as long as it helps Israel contain Gaza, then Obama and other administrations have let the Egyptians do whatever they want, the Mubarak regime do whatever they want to the Egyptian people. Finally, the last opponent of this movement is really the Israeli state. Now, there are lots of people in Israel who are hoping for a democratic rule in Egypt because it will probably, likely in the long run, be a better source of security for Israel. But right now, the ruling party in Israel loves Omar Suleiman. Why? He's their guy. He's the guy who has liaisoned with them over Gaza. He likes the fact that he has been... I won't keep going on, but there's a number of opponents from this outside, and Suleiman and the other generals, you know, Shafiq, and Tantawi, this trio, this new, I think, de facto ruling junta, these guys are all approved in the U.S., approved in Riyadh, and approved in Tel Aviv. And this, and their unpopularity on the Egyptian street has got to be scary.
Well, what's Tahrir's called Mubarak's poodle, I understand, but I think this, to some extent, it seems clear to me, Elliot Kohler, that the Saudi king, and I believe he has called President Obama, and the Israelis have been weighing in on Obama, telling him not to show Mubarak the door so quickly. That would explain, I think, what people are seeing, some sort of waffling there. On the one hand, today he again reached out to the young people in Egypt and said, "You're the people who are bringing this about, and you're the future." So I think he, by and large, he seems to be getting it right, wouldn't you say? But and I think in this bizarre non-resignation speech of Mubarak's, his allusion to foreign interference seemed, to my mind, to be directed at Obama, like, "How dare you tell me to get the hell out of here?" You know,
it would be the height of hypocrisy for a man who has not only taken, but likely embezzled $1.5 billion a year of U.S. taxpayer money, to then turn around and complain about foreign meddling in internal Egyptian affairs. And that is why Mubarak's speech will be parsed by analysts for years to come. But that is one line that showed really how out of touch he is. Mubarak was America's man. And I still believe, despite what Obama was doing, or what he might have said today, he's still their preferred guy. If not him, maybe a more palatable version of him, sort of a new old guy.
Right.
Right? From the same
clip. You mean the torturer?
The torture. That's right.
Good Lord. I mean, by the way, Elliot Kohler, I understand that there's a report that the Saudi Arabian king had promised Mubarak that if the Americans pull their $1.5 billion a year military aid, the Saudis will step up and replace it.
Right. It's actually most of that money does not actually go to Egypt. It goes to the Egyptian army, and in fact, most of that money that goes to the Egyptian army doesn't even leave the U.S. soil, because it goes to U.S. defense contractors, who also are lining up as part of this array against the pro-democracy forces. Because, well, if Egyptians are demanding civilian rule rather than a military junta, well, the military spending in Egypt is going to go way down. And right now, this $1.5 million
billion
of aid is mostly going to U.S. based defense corporations who stand to profit. So those lobbyists have been working hard in this city as well in the last 2.5 weeks to prevent any kind of meaningful.
Well, Elliot Kohler, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles. It's been a pleasure talking with you. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Elliot Kohler, who's the chair of the Department of Arabic and Islamic Studies at Georgetown University, and he testified this week to the United States Congress. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Republican budget, which the Republicans in the House have been arguing about. So we'll get some details.
The police don't solve crimes or prevent crimes so much as arrest boys and girls who look at them funny. I mean, so yes, order is not. This is not a regime that can provide order or any kind of benefits in that regard to the Egyptian people. Now, I mentioned how complicated the array of opposition is to the pro-democracy movement inside Egypt. We need to remember that there's an array of anti or opponents to a popular revolution in Egypt outside of Egypt too. For instance, Saudi Arabia and the other authoritarian regimes in the Arab world, they have no interest in letting Egypt set an example for their own people. The Obama administration, like other administrations in the U.S. before him, has always preferred not to think about Egypt or just to think of it as a status quo, a black box. As long as Egypt provides intelligence on the war on terror, as long as it enforces the Camp David Treaty with Israel, as long as it helps Israel contain Gaza, then Obama and other administrations have let the Egyptians do whatever they want, the Mubarak regime do whatever they want to the Egyptian people. Finally, the last opponent of this movement is really the Israeli state. Now, there are lots of people in Israel who are hoping for a democratic rule in Egypt because it will probably, likely in the long run, be a better source of security for Israel. But right now, the ruling party in Israel loves Omar Suleiman. Why? He's their guy. He's the guy who has liaisoned with them over Gaza. He likes the fact that he has been I won't keep going on, but there's a number of opponents from this outside, and Suleiman and the other generals, you know, Shafiq and Tantawi, this trio, this new, I think, de facto ruling junta, these guys are all approved in the U.S., approved in Riyadh, and approved in Tel Aviv. And their unpopularity on the Egyptian street has got to be scary.
Well, Tahrir's called Mubarak's poodle, I understand, but I think that to some extent it seems clear to me, Elliot Kohler, that the Saudi king, and I believe he has called President Obama, and the Israelis have been weighing in on Obama, telling him not to show Mubarak the door so quickly. That would explain, I think, what people are seeing, some sort of waffling there. On the one hand, today he again reached out to the young people in Egypt and said, "You're the people who are bringing this about, and you're the future." So I think by and large, he seems to be getting it right, wouldn't you say? But and I think in this bizarre non-resignation speech of Mubarak's, his allusion to foreign interference seemed, to my mind, to be directed at Obama. Like, how dare you tell me to get the hell out of here? You know,
it would be the height of hypocrisy for a man who has not only taken, but likely embezzled $1.5 billion a year of U.S. taxpayer money, to then turn around and complain about foreign meddling in internal Egyptian affairs. And that is why Mubarak's speech will be parsed by analysts for years to come. But that is one line that showed really how out of touch he is. Mubarak was America's man. And I still believe, despite what Obama was doing, or what he might have said today, he's still their preferred guy. If not him, maybe a more palatable version of him, sort of a new old guy.
Right. Right? From the same group. You mean the torturer?
The torture. That's right.
Good Lord. I mean, by the way, Elliot Kohler, I understand that there's a report that the Saudi Arabian king had promised Mubarak that if the Americans pull their $1.5 billion a year military aid, the Saudis will step up and replace it.
Right. It's actually most of that money does not actually go to Egypt. It goes to the Egyptian army, and in fact, most of that money that goes to the Egyptian army doesn't even leave the U.S. soil, because it goes to U.S. defense contractors, who also are lining up and as part of this array against the pro-democracy forces. Because, well, if Egyptians are demanding civilian rule rather than a military junta, well, the military spending in Egypt is going to go way down. And right now, this $1.5 million of aid is mostly going to U.S.-based defense corporations who stand to profit. So those lobbyists have been working hard in this city as well in the last 2.5 weeks to prevent any kind of meaningful.
Well, Elliot Kohler, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles. It's been a pleasure talking with you. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Elliot Kohler, who's the chair of the Department of Arabic and Islamic Studies at Georgetown University, and he testified this week to the United States Congress. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Republican budget, which the Republicans in the House have been arguing about. So we'll get some details.
On the next edition of Uprising, we'll have an hour-long special on the unfolding situation in Egypt. We'll speak with Lisa Hajar and Rahul Mahajan, as well as get live updates from Tahrir Square. And Leila El-Haddad will address the impact of Egypt on Palestinians. We'll also hear excerpts of Hosni Mubarak's speech. Join me, Sonali Kohatkar, on Uprising weekdays at 8 a.m. right here at KPFK.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is a Background Briefing, and I'm joined by Dean Baker, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. His latest book is Taking Economics Seriously. He also wrote Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, and in 1999, Social Security, The Phony Crisis. His blog, Beat the Press, elaborates critical issues in American media. And it seems that the Republicans have been arguing amongst themselves over how much they want to cut from the federal budget. Apparently, they didn't want it. The Tea Party is showing its muscle here, and now they're talking about, instead of about $40 billion in cuts, $100 billion in cuts. Dean Baker, how are we to take this seriously? Because on the one hand, they're not going to cut anything from defense, but they want to cut foreign aid. And anybody that knows anything about the new security profile and out there in the world knows that we lost Iraq because we didn't deliver on aid and infrastructure. We're in the process of leaving Afghanistan because we haven't delivered on civilian aid and infrastructure. And here they are wanting to cut that. And they also want to cut a lot of money out of the Department of Energy in terms of alternative energy, green energy, conservation, etc. At the same time, they don't want to end subsidies for their powerful friends in the oil industry. So is this just a farce?
Well, a lot of this is Washington's a farce. I mean, frankly, I have to say, I don't know, our lack of aid to Iraq or Afghanistan was the reasons that we've had problems there. We're not very good at occupying power. Not many countries are. So I think that's the bigger cause. But that aside, I mean, they did this tirade about, out-of-control spending, and they're saying they want to cut out-of-control spending. The reality is that the areas of spending they're looking to actually aren't that large, and once you start cutting any significant amount there, you're going to hit real services that people tend to value. So you're talking about cutting back, they're talking about cutting back on funding for the National Institutes of Health, so new research, cutting back programs to provide care for mothers with newborn kids. It's easy abstractly to yell about government waste, and surely there is some, but the reality is once you start talking about cutting large amounts of money, you're not cutting government waste because there's no bucket there that just sits there, government waste, so we could just say, let's get rid of that. You're talking about cutting real programs that the fact is most people really do value.
But Dean Baker, aren't they only talking about 12% of the budget? And that's the part of it that I find surreal, that they're making all of this noise over cutting 12%.
Well, I find that part somewhat surreal, but let me find what I find more surreal is that we're having an argument over the budget when you have 9% of the population, 9% of the workforce unemployed. It's just kind of amazing that here you've had, we're in the worst downturn since the Great Depression. We have 25 million people unemployed, underemployed, giving up work altogether, and no one's talking about that. We're talking about these silly budget cuts. I mean, that's what's really amazing.
Well, but that's a part of this incredibly successful deficit hoax, isn't it? Yeah.
And unfortunately, President Obama's going along with it. So rather than getting out there and going, look, we have to spend money to create jobs, and it's not because, I mean, you could put in the exact wording, but the point is it's not because you like to have the government spend money, but the reality is that the private sector is not going to do it right now. And we could, say nice things to all the business executives, tell them they're wonderful people and everything, and they're still not going to invest because business don't invest because you tell them they're wonderful people. They invest because they expect to make a profit, and they're not going to do that when there's no demand in the economy. But unfortunately, that discussion, I know people in the administration, they say, oh, we can't say that, even though it's true, and everyone knows it's true.
Well, but Bernanke, in testimony today, did say that we need more stimulus, and he's not afraid of, unlike his predecessor, he's not afraid of inflation.
Well, I'm sure he is afraid of inflation, but reality is, you know, there's no.
He didn't think it was a factor.
Story about inflation right now.
Right.
But yeah, no, I appreciate that, and it's good that he's been willing to come forward and say that because he's one of the few people in Washington. You know, he's not up for re-election, so he's in a position to say it, and, you know, thankfully he's been doing that and pressing on it. I don't know how much impact it has, but it's better that, you know, at least he says it than he doesn't.
Again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economics and Policy Research. He's also has a blog, Beat the Press, and we're talking about how the Tea Party within the Republican caucus, they've been arguing over budget cuts, and the Tea Party, the new freshmen, have shown some muscle here and demanding more cuts. But the question is any of this realistic? And most of it only applies to the 12% of the budget that's already been systematically cut over the years. But they're talking also, of course, some of this seems so blatantly ideological. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting zeroing that out, Clinton's AmeriCorps. But again, the cuts that I find particularly hypocritical are in energy conservation. I mean, doesn't anybody... How many times have you heard presidents and George W. Bush talking about our dependency on foreign oil? I mean,
it's utterly absurd. And, you know, they've been pushing the Smith. And again, I blame President Obama somewhat for not being more aggressive on this. That, you know, they've been pushing this idea, oh, if we would just drill everywhere. You remember Sarah Palin at the convention, her drill baby drill, and the drill here, drill now. So if we just drilled for oil everywhere, somehow we'll be independent. And, you know, of course, the two big problems with that story, one is what we saw with the BP oil spill. It does risk the environment, and I'm just amazed that you know, these people, if we had anything resembling sort of normal discourse, they would have to wear a bag over their head for the next 20 years. I mean, that was a disaster. It damaged the environment. It damaged, you know, they care about business jobs. Well, you can't very well have a tourism industry when your beaches are covered with oil. You know, it doesn't help your fishing industry when you're pulling up fish, that, you know, shrimp that are black. You know, so that part of the story didn't make sense. The other part is we don't have that much oil, and everyone knows that. And, you know, if you talk about energy independence, there's this reporter in the Washington Post, not reporter, columnist in the Washington Post, Robert Samuelson, I always love making fun of. He had this thing about, oh, we should be drilling everywhere. Well, if you drill everywhere, you pull the oil out and it's gone. That doesn't make you independent. You know, if we're really concerned that we're going to have this situation where the bad guys team up on us and won't sell us oil, well, then that's the time we'd really be happy to have the oil in the ground. If we've already drilled it out, then we don't have it. So then if the bad guys want to get us, well, then they can get us because we don't have any oil left. And it's just, that's like, it's simple. My joke about Robert Samuelson was you can't burn your oil and have it too. So if we want to be concerned about, you know, we might be cut off from oil at some point, last thing on earth you should want to do is drill all your oil out of the ground now.
Well, Dean Baker, you know, WikiLeaks apparently have revealed a document from a very high-ranking insider in Aramco, the Saudi oil company, who told American diplomats that they've been lying about their reserves by at least 40% and that they've reached peak oil.
I mean, well, they may have. I mean, look, there's been this bizarre, I really frankly can't understand it, this bizarre obsession about peak oil. And the reality is anyone who tells you they know what peak oil is not telling you the truth. We don't know, and it really doesn't matter. What we do know is that demand is outstripping supply, and that means prices are going to rise. And it doesn't matter whether we hit peak oil in 2015, 2025, or 2045. In all of those scenarios, demand is rising more rapidly than supply. It's going to raise the price. So this obsession about peak oil is really kind of a sidebar. The more basic point we all know to be true, so there's really nothing to argue over.
Well, but I bring it up because of the fundamental counterintuitive nature of the Republicans in the House, and particularly the Tea Party people, who are supposed to represent some breath of fresh air. But they looking like they're shilling for the dirtiest, the most entrenched industries like coal and oil, and protecting these absolutely unnecessary subsidies for these companies that are making record profits. At the same time, cutting
all of the funding out of any alternative, including the high-speed rail project here in California, all of the alternative energy projects they want to cut. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
No, it's not a long term. It's not a mid term. It's not even a near term strategy. Because again, you know, in the near term, this spending is a great thing. It creates jobs. You know, and it's not as though they have some alternative plan. It's not, you know, if we actually found the Department of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse and cut its budget, that's not going to create jobs. Because right now, we need demand in the economy, and cutting government spending is not going to generate demand. At least not in any story I know how to tell.
So is it possible then, Dean Baker, that Fred Upton and these new chairs and Hal Rogers, that the fact that the Koch brothers put all that money into the Tea Party, is it now becoming apparent that it's the Koch brothers who are getting their way in this country? The Tea Party doesn't have any ideology. They're just a bunch of shills for billionaires.
It's hard to say. I mean, it should be apparent, but it should have been apparent before that, you know, this is a group of people. I mean, some of them, I'm sure, are sincere, but nonetheless, they're being manipulated by people who have other agendas. You know, I think that should have been apparent long ago, but now
it's in the ink of the budget. Now we know what their priorities are.
Well, we haven't
got the full budget yet, but this is what apparently they're talking about.
I mean, I don't know there'll be any great breakthroughs or revelations. As I say, a lot of these things should have been pretty evident long ago. You know, running around drill baby drill when,
sure.
You know, we have pretty good data on how much oil is potentially there. It really doesn't change anything. Even if we drill here, drill now, and drain it all out, it really doesn't change anything in terms of the fact that, you know, there's a limited amount of oil there, and we're going to be dependent on either foreign sources or alternative energies. Those are our choices.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles. Dean Baker, again, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He also has a popular blog, Beat the Press. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing, engineer Devin Jordan, and I'll be back on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another background briefing. Until then, have a very pleasant couple of days. Bye for now. The guy that lived next